Hey, everybody, Alan Arnett here with another podcast on the blog on alanarnett.com. It is Saturday, February 25th, 2023. I know it's been a while since I did a podcast, but, you know, I have this philosophy that if I don't have something to say, I'm not going to do a podcast because, as you know, I'm not sponsored on this podcast. The only thing I'll ever pitch is my Summit Coach consulting services that helps climbers get into climbing. I've got several clients this year going to Mount Everest. I just got finished having 8 people in Aconcagua. So if you're interested in getting some help and getting into mountaineering or making sure that you're totally prepared to go, then contact me through Summit Coach. The links are on the site. That is the only advertisement you're ever going to hear from me on these podcasts. So one of the things that has gotten my attention over the last 6 months, or maybe over the last year, is the change in style that we've seen in climbing on Everest. I wrote a lot about it last year. I finished up some of my 2022 podcast talking about it. So I'm not going to belabor the point other than to say that, things have changed. And as I wrote in my recent article of how much does it cost to climb Mount Everest 2023 edition, that, there are some significant changes going on in the landscape of climbing all of these mountains. We saw it on Aconcagua this past January and February, with lots of people up there. Sadly, lots of inexperienced people were up there. 3 people died. A couple of them went against the guidelines of the company they were climbing with. Weather was pretty horrific early on in the season, then it cleared back out. But what we're seeing is that mountaineering is attracting a lot more people than ever before. And there's a guide industry is really catering to that demand. And this is no different than any other business in the world, be it, airlines or cruise ships or especially the tourism industry, that supply and demand drives the business model. And what we're seeing in Nepal, especially, are the Nepali companies that are catering to a lot of different demographics, especially those people with low experience. Some are not. Some are doing an outstanding job, and I really applaud those Nepali operators that are keeping high standards and also training their staff to have not only the cultural and language skills, but also things like medical training in addition to basic climbing skills. So there are, like in any industry, any business, there's good ones and bad ones out there. And that goes for foreign companies as well. In other words, the non-Nepalis. But what we're seeing is that the Nepali companies are attracting anywhere from 50, 60 to 100 clients, where the traditional Western companies, let's say like the adventure consultants, they're still keeping their numbers down around the 10 level. And you may see some that'll teeter up into between 20 and 30, like Climbing the Seven Summits or Garrett Madison. But for the most part, the Nepali companies are having the really large teams, and thus they're charging a lower price. And the traditional Western companies are having relatively smaller teams, and they're charging a higher price. Just do the math and you'll figure out, that basically it's a business model and different companies have different philosophies on that. One thing that is really still a problem, though, and it's on both sides of Everest, the Tibet side as well as the Nepal side, is the trash and the whole idea of adhering to leave no trace principles. I really wish the operators would step up and really make all of their clients use wag bags to remove solid human waste. I keep seeing this stuff from different operators saying that they're going to raise money this year to go clean Everest. I've seen it from the governments, both Nepal and China, but yet I still see reports coming back that Camp 2, especially on the Nepal side and the South Col, the conditions are just abysmal. So I certainly applaud those companies who are saying they're going to do cleanups this year, and I certainly hope they follow through. Something else going on this year for 2023 is that pricing. So overall, it's really hard to compare it over the last couple of years with COVID in terms of what the pricing is. So you almost have to go back to 2019. That was the last year when there was what I would call a normal year, if there's ever a normal year climbing Mount Everest. But in 2019, if you want to go with a Nepali service, they were charging around $35,000. This year, the list price that some of them are showing, and many of them are not showing their prices at all anymore because they want to talk to you and they want to get you into the conversation, and then they'll begin to negotiate. But those that do list prices now talk about $45,000. So about a 22% increase back from 2019. And that's on the Tibet side, $35,000 to $45,000. So on the Tibet side, look to spend about $45,000 going with the Nepali company. On the Nepal side, the prices have gone up quite a bit. And now they're at 50,000 on a median going with a Nepali company. And if you want to go with a foreign company like Madison Mountaineering, then that they're in the neighborhood of 70,000. Freudenbach, Alpenglow, they're even higher than that, but typically they focus on the north side. So the prices are kind of a big, big range, and you can find whatever price you're looking for. The lowest that I think that anybody can get on Everest right now is around 30,000, and that's a no-frills base camp only. It not even, may not even include oxygen, and it certainly doesn't include a personal Sherpa that'll be climbing with you the whole way. The other end of the spectrum, there's some really crazy stuff out there that you can get a you know, the VIP or the luxury the big dome tents just for your personal tent, and there you're going to be paying 120,000-200,000. It's just crazy. The sky's the limit there, and you really have to question whether this is mountaineering or just adventure tourism at this point. And I know what a lot of you think. That ship has sailed. And, you know, in some ways, I'm not sure I'm going to disagree with you, because as I said, these days, the level of Sherpa support, it used to be that, let's say 20 years ago, that you would have one client and less than one Sherpa supporting that one client. In other words, maybe two Sherpas for each client. Now, it can, two clients for each Sherpa. Now it could be two Sherpas for each client. And in some rare cases, it could be five or six Sherpas for one client. And what's happening is, I talked about this last year with the other 8,000 meter mountains, that they're, the Sherpas are going up, they're breaking trail, they're establishing the high camps. In some cases, that the clients are staying back in Kathmandu and only coming in once the trail is put in place. And then they're following the boot path up to the summit and back down. And, you know, so one of the things that I always found incredibly enjoyable about any of my expeditions, be it in Tibet or Nepal or, you know, anywhere where I had Sherpa support, was getting to know those people, and people like Kami Sherpa, you know, K2 with Kami Rita and Mingma Sherpa, you know, getting to know those people and just really becoming what I would consider to be friends with them, especially Kami. Kami and I still stay in touch even to this day, even though we haven't climbed since the last time, I think it was 2019 on Island Peak, but I still stay in touch with his family and lifelong friends. And that's really a lot. That's really what I think a lot of this is all about, is that camaraderie with your teammates, with the support, with your overall expedition, and making those lifelong friends. So looking ahead, you know, I thought that we were going to see a couple of teams climbing, foreign teams on the Tibet side, but it looks like China has closed the door on that. I'm told that it has to do with the logistics of getting foreign visas. I think it's complicated with a lot of international difficulties, if I can be politically correct here. And also with the COVID situation, even though Tibet or China has eased their no COVID policy, there's still complications and echoes from that. So I think they said, you know what, Everest is off for the springtime. I've heard they may open it up for the fall. So that would be for Shishapangma and Choyoyu. So there's two or three people are trying to get all 14 of the 8,000 meter mountains in what they would consider to be record time. So right now, those two in Tibet, climbing Choy from Tibet and climbing Shisha, which is the only 8,000 meter fully within Tibet, there looks like now they're going to have to wait till the autumn to do that. So I'm going to hope to interview a couple of these people that are going for the, you know, the 8,000 record here over the next month or so before they leave for Everest or wherever they're going to go next, and kind of get their first person report on that. And so Nepal is going to be the show. It's not going to be the Tibet side. China will still let a Chinese team climb on the Tibet side. Last year in 2023, I think there were 12 people that summited last year. So, you know, we'll probably see the same thing on the Tibet side. So that means on the Nepal side, we're going to see, again, similar numbers to, I think, what we saw this year or last year in 2022, maybe about 100 more. According to the Himalayan database last year, so in 2022, it looks like on the Nepal side, there were roughly around 240 clients or members. In other words, people are paying for a permit, and they were supported by almost 399 Sherpas. So 240 clients to 400 Sherpas for 640 summits on the Nepal side. That is a big, big support ratio right there. I think there were about 200 other people that summited, including Sherpas, that summited the other 8,000 meter mountains. And for the success rate on Everest on the Nepal side, it was roughly 240 members out of the 325 permits that were issued. So the success rate for clients was around 74%, which is about on par with the historical averages. Looking at the bigger picture of all time, there's been about 11,300 total summits of Mount Everest since 1953. And that's by all routes. And that is by, so of the 11,300 summits, that's by 6,300 people. And of that, there's been more Sherpas that now have summited Everest than clients. So really, Everest is becoming a true Nepali mountain, and Sherpas are often climbing not only to be paid to guide other clients, but sometimes climbing for themselves, which I think is great. You know, it's just like any other mountain around the world. The indigenous people have just as much right and ability to climb the mountains as anybody else, whether it be, you know, Alpa Mayo in Peru or Denali in Alaska or the Matterhorn in, Switzerland, whatever it happens to be. You know, still the use of supplemental oxygen is really low. It's hovering around 2% or so of the total people. You still have to be genetically gifted in order to climb Mount Everest without oxygen. The death rate has stayed pretty much consistent as well. So far, it's around up to last year, about 309 people have died. That's 199 Westerners have died compared to 110 Sherpas that have died. So the death rate is around 2.9%. You know, comparing that with other mountains around the world, Everest is statistically one of the safest mountains. And that's really because that now the support, the Sherpa support is much, much higher than it ever has been. As I said before, it's gone from, let's say, two clients for one Sherpa to two clients or two Sherpas for one client. Also, the use of supplemental oxygen has dramatically changed. You know, when I first started using supplemental oxygen, my first 8,000 meter back in the late 90s on Choyo-U, it was like I was using this Russian MiG pilot fighter oxygen mask, and it leaked so much, and the oxygen delivery system was horrible, and I felt like I climbed that thing without oxygen compared to when I used the other systems lately, like Summit Oxygen and Top Out. Much more sophisticated, they don't leak as much, the regulators are much more efficient, and as a result now, we're seeing climbers that are using 4 to 6, and a couple of companies are even modifying the regulator to get to 8 liters per minute. So you have to step aside on the style thing. I know some of you listening to this will go, "Oh, Alan, you know, they're cheating, is doping." You know, maybe so. But all I can tell you is that oxygen makes the body stay warmer. And so only 3% of the people that summit Everest don't use oxygen. And the death rate is significantly higher for those people who do not. You know, full stop, the human body was not meant to survive at these extreme altitudes. And so those people that can climb without using it, they're genetically gifted. And I tell you what, I'm not one of those people. So if you look at other death rates in other mountains, Annapurna is still up there. It's probably the highest of all of them, even though it's come down dramatically with the number of people that have successfully been able to summit Annapurna, especially last year. K2 has also dropped. You know, K2 was in the neighborhood of 25%. Now it's in the high teens, maybe 17, 18%. Again, this is because more people are climbing using oxygen, using support. They're using the known routes. Weather forecasting has improved. Technology around all the gear, be it boots and layers, everything has improved. So we're seeing the natural benefit of all of those improvements, and it's all translating into higher number of people summiting with lower death rates. Again, you can argue that, you know, hey, this is not fair. It's not like it was back in 1960. You know what? You're right. Neither was flying airplanes back in 1960 compared to today. Technology and everything else advances. So, you know, this is kind of where it stands. So I'm going to be covering the 23 season on Everest and the other 8,000 meter mountains. Not quite the same detail that I have in the past years, because it just seems to me there's a lot of people up there climbing to get their selfie or to get their name in the press, to claim a record. There's a lot of self-promotion going on these days, all the way from some high-profile guides to some high-profile individual climbers. A lot of people seeking records. So I'm going to look for those people that I think are a special story. They're climbing for their own reasons, not for fame and fortune and all of that, but they're climbing for the joy of climbing and the joy of mountaineering. That's what I think it's all about. You know, last weekend I went ice climbing here in Colorado down to Lake City, down in Southwest Colorado with 11 friends. You know, I suck at ice climbing. I'm not very good, but I had a great, great time down there with my friends. You know, it didn't matter if you got to the top of the rope or you just got 20 feet off the ground. It was just a great experience overall. And I think that's what all this mountaineering is supposed to be about. Get out there, give it your best. You know, if you make the summit, great. If you don't, great. You know, it's all about the experience. It's about really pressing yourself and learning, finding what your limits are, seeing if you can go beyond it. You come home a better version of yourself. That's what I think this is all about. So I got a couple of podcasts planned coming up that we'll cover before the 23 season. But until then, climb on. This is Alan. And remember, memories are everything.